Happy to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. And we're beginning our program today by taking a look at the critical role that smell plays in our lives. Our guest is Avery Gilbert from Montclair, New Jersey. He's a smell scientist, psychologist, entrepreneur, and also an author and a very good writer. His book is called What the Nose Knows, The Science of Scent in Everyday Life. It's published by Crown Publishers, and I'm really pleased to have him with us today to talk about the role that smell plays in our lives and what the nose really knows. And so if you'd like to join in, already a caller online, you can join in too at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. Avery Gilbert, welcome to the program. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
It's my pleasure, Larry.
I really enjoyed your book. I'll just say that right out. I really, really enjoyed your book. A very entertaining. I was laughing a lot of times and just shaking my head in awe at what you know about nose and smell.
Well, that's it's such a pleasure to hear that, because I put my heart and soul into that book for a couple of years and kind of went off the radar to do it. But to come back to such raves, I can't tell you how happy that makes me.
What? How did you get so interested in smell and nose?
Well, you know, nobody in the fragrance business goes there directly, unless your parents are perfumers.
Okay.
Everybody kind of backs into it. My route was through rat sex, believe it or not. My interest was in animal behavior. And in college, and I kept doing that in graduate school, and so much of animal behavior involves smell, and, you know, scent marking, identifying mates, offspring, and so forth. And one day I decided to do an experiment on human odor perception, and there I went.
And there you went. It didn't turn out as well as you'd liked, as I recall, but that first experiment. But then you worked in the perfume business and still probably do a little of that, don't you?
Yeah, well, I spent a number of years doing basic research at the Monell Chemical Senses Center, which is a research institute in Philadelphia for taste and smell. And, human odor perception is still an uncharted field, so I did a lot of basic work there. And then I was recruited into the fragrance industry, joining a multinational company, helping design scents for commercial products and do consumer work.
And as I think about smell, can you describe, and you do, you certainly do in your book, what happens when we sniff something in? How does that smell wind up being a smell for us?
Well, physically, smells are volatile molecules, which means that they're light enough to evaporate and float in the air. And in the usual scene, we inhale them through our nostrils, and these molecules go way up into the upper reaches of our nasal passages where they make contact with sensory cells. And the smell molecule fits into a receptor protein on the surface of the sensory cell, much like think of a softball going into a softball mitt. Mm-hmm. When that connection is made, the cell fires a signal. So smell is basically a chemical message in the environment being transformed into an electrical message in the nerve that then goes up to the brain.
And how many smells are there? Not as many as maybe some people have estimated in past?
Well, you know, there's this crazy number that I've always seen for years and years now about humans are able to smell 10,000 odors.
Yeah, 10,000.
Which is a nice fat round number. And yet when I started looking for a source of it, I couldn't find one. Nobody seems to have done an actual experiment on it. I tracked it back to a couple of Arthur D. Little chemists back in the 1920s who were trying to figure out how to classify smells. And they had a sort of a system, but basically there's no empirical evidence that there are 10,000. That was their kind of horseback estimate. And in some ways, I think that's asking the wrong question. In other words, I think we categorize smells into categories, and that's how we deal with it, much like colors. The eye can discriminate millions of colors, and yet 6 or 8 color terms are enough for us to get by in every culture in the world. And I think, similarly, of all the millions of different smelling molecules, we kind of group them into about 1, maybe 2 dozen smell categories, and that's what works.
And that's what works for us. And you have a lot of fun in your book talking about smell and so forth as it relates to wine. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, yeah, we have these idea of the wine snob with the shaggy dog, the wet dog odor, and the pretentious little Pinot Noir, and all that kind of sideways movie jargon that they use. It can get pretty heavy going at times. What I like is a wine chemist at UC Davis in California, Ann Noble, who broke it down much more simply. She made a chart with all the different aromas that are in wine, good and bad, and then made a simple way for people to experience that. So, you know, a berry aroma, a raspberry aroma, she takes a standard wine and crushes a raspberry in it, lets it soak for a while, and then that becomes the standard. So it's very practical. Anybody can do it. And in fact, if you've got just a basically good nose, you can learn wine. You don't have to become a snob. You don't have to be a snob to enjoy it.
Well, you write very entertainingly about that. I want to give some of our listeners a chance to join in. Anita in Bonduelle has been waiting a while, so let's go to Anita. Hi, Anita.
Good morning, Larry. Good morning, Avery. I was wondering, my daughter was in an accident and had a severe brain injury, and I've noticed since I've gotten her home that she has, she says she doesn't have much of a sense of smell and no appetite at all. So I was just wondering what your guest could maybe tell me about that.
Yeah, you're right about that.
I'm sorry to hear that, but yeah, it's very possible she has damaged her her nose in a way. Head injury is the second biggest cause of smell loss. The little fibers that go, the nerve fibers that go from the nose up to the brain, can get sheared off with even a minor blow to the head. I mean, if you get blinked on the head with a baseball bat as a catcher, that's enough to do it. So an automobile injury or major head trauma, you can often lose greater or lesser parts of your smell, and unfortunately, I don't know much that can be done to bring it back. There's some chance you might have residual function, and certainly the eating becomes an issue for a lot of people.
And the eating becomes an issue for a lot of people because smell has so much to do with how we enjoy our food, as you write about.
Absolutely. What we think of as a flavor is really a fusion of two separate senses. You've got taste in the tongue and the taste buds, and that's, you know, five things: sweet, sour, salty, bitter, and umami, you know, mm-hmm. the savory taste of MSG. And yet in the nose, you've got 350 different receptors, and you've got a whole variety of smells you can pick up. And those fuse in the mouth and come up the back of the nose. The aroma of the food as we chew it or the wine as we drink it comes up the back of the throat to those same receptors. It gives us the impression of flavor. So when you lose your sense of smell, that, you know, even caviar starts to just taste like flat oatmeal.
Yeah, yeah. So there you have it, Anita. Thank you very much for calling, and I'm really sorry for your daughter's accident. Dorothy in Maquantico, we'll turn to you. Hi, Dorothy.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm interested in hearing what your guest has to say about parosmia and then a loss of smell and taste.
Parosmia is one of these strange medical conditions where it's not simply a loss of smell, but a distortion of smell. And it's actually fairly common. In a neurologist's office, you'll see cases of it on a regular basis, where what is a normal smell to everybody else in the room smells off to the person with parosmia. So the case I give is a woman who woke up one morning and everything smelled like burnt toast, no matter what she was smelling. And it's very strange. Possibly happens as a result of rewiring of the brain after a injury to the olfactory system. So it's kind of a miswiring of the smell receptors to the perceiving part of the brain.
Mm-hmm. This is something that may or may not come back.
It can come and go. All kinds of different things have been tried as treatments, from anticonvulsive drugs to antiviral drugs. I'm not sure the doctors really have a good handle on it.
Yeah. Thanks, Dorothy. Carl in Peshtigo, your turn. Hi, Carl.
Yes, I had a slight injury back in 2004. Head injury, which is minor. I didn't have no headache of it or concussion of it, but I lost my sense of smell and taste. But now it's coming back, and sometimes my sense of smell is so sensitive to certain smells that, a lot of other people don't smell it. And I used to be very sensitive to smoke and alcohol, which I was pretty much against that one time. And my sense and that smell is not as intense as other smells are.
Hmm.
Well, that's interesting. So it's sort of working out for you. Maybe maybe the nerves and are restoring themselves a bit, and you're getting a kind of selective, occasional view of the smellscape, so to speak.
Yeah. And thanks, Carl, for calling. I appreciate it. You write, too, about people who, rather than losing their sense of smell, seem to be sensitive to a whole host of smells.
Yeah, there's this, for about 30 years, there have been a group of people who variously identified themselves as having multiple chemical sensitivities, or now, as it's been renamed, idiopathic environmental irritation, I believe. Doctors have grappled with this. These people are definitely suffering. I've spoken with many of them. They're anxious and miserable and unhappy and want help. They tend to believe that their symptoms are caused by smells or toxic vapors of various sorts. Doctors are frustrated because they can't identify one particular type of smell. I mean, usually if you have an allergy, there's one or two, say, pollens or things that cause it, and it's very difficult to pin down. What I point out in the book is that even healthy people can be convinced in the right circumstances that that a mild smell is harmful, and as a consequence, they'll have negative physical symptoms. So what puzzles me is that, you know, even if we assume that this MCS syndrome is purely physical, why wouldn't people want to have a psychological therapy as well? Why not treat the whole person?
Yeah. Yeah, it makes some sense. You even talk about smells that that people never forget, and you use a good example, I think, of a guy in California who smelled something that smelled like human flesh burning.
Oh yeah, it's a grim but very powerful story. He was an Army veteran from the Second World War who had helped liberate some of the concentration camps, where he smelled that smell of burning flesh, and it stayed with him. And then many years later, he's in an industrial area down near the Mojave Desert and smells it coming from this kiln shop, pottery shop or something, and he tells the police, "I know that smell. You got to go check this out." And the police were saying, "Yeah, sure, buddy," but they did check it out, and it turned out it unraveled the biggest funeral home mortuary cremation scandal in Southern California history. These guys were stuffing all the customers into big ovens completely against laws and regulations, and so it had a happy ending that way. It did sort things out, but the nose does know.
My wife can smell things. She has got a nose like you wouldn't believe. Jim Packard says his wife, Deb, is the same way, and we're wondering, and you talk about this, on average, do women have a keener nose than men?
Yeah. If you're looking at kind of team averages, the women's team does win. You know, it goes along with other results in psychology that women are better at identifying smells at a low level, picking them up, perceiving it's there. They're also generally better at naming smells, which goes with female superiority at verbal tasks. You know, on the other hand, these are small, relatively small differences, and on either team there are huge differences. So there's some men who are superb smellers and some women who are terrible, but on average that's the way it plays out. So, yeah, you're going to have to give the ladies credit on this one.
What makes for a good sense of smell?
Well, interestingly, the nose is just part of it. I've known a lot of perfumers and tested them in the lab. I think an adequate nose is needed to have a good sense of smell, but what you really need is the brain. You need to have that sort of awareness of smell, be attuned to them, kind of interested in them, and then just have a flair for, you know, keeping them in mind, remembering them, comparing them, and anticipating how they'll smell in combination. So it's that, I liken it to color. I don't, you know, I'm not very confident putting together combinations of ties, shirts, and jackets, but
yeah.
My wife is. So I leave that to her. But in the same way, there are people who are just very confident about combining smells. And boy, those people have a great opportunity to be a perfumer, for example.
Yeah. Avery Gilbert, our guest today, a smell scientist, psychologist, entrepreneur, and author of What the Nose Knows, the Science of Scent in Everyday Life. We'll be talking with him. We'll be continuing to talk with him. And if you would like to join in, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. I want to get into part of his book. He talks about how marketers use smell and some entertaining and interesting things there. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Avery Gilbert, our guest today, author of What the Nose Knows, The Science of Scent in Everyday Life. It's published by Crown Publishers, a very entertaining book about the science of smell, and really pleased to have him with us today to talk about his book and about smell. And lots of callers online, but before we go back to the phones, is this whole business about marketing, using smell to smells to market has some interesting history. And I guess I don't remember my first introduction to it, but certainly bakers have long known, little bakery shops have long known that smell, blowing the odors, the aromas, the baking aromas out their window or out their kind of out their doors somehow really does help sales.
Sure. The same thing with pizza parlors. Leave the door open and you'll draw people in off the street. Scent marketing is one of these perennial ideas. I found it going back about 100 years in the commercial literature, people saying, the next big thing in marketing is going to be smell, from 1924, and then again from 1938, and so forth. It's one of these ideas that's always about to happen, and marketers get very enthusiastic about it. But then it turns out, in the past, it's been hard to carry off, to actually compose and present smells in a retail shop, unless it's a bakery or somewhere the smell is part of the merchandise. It's not easy, and that's beginning to change now. Where there are a lot of devices that are available where, you know, you can walk past a perfume counter and just motion of you walking past will send a little tiny puff of a fragrance toward you. Or other devices that could scent a whole area of a retail store or even an entire, say, concert venue. You know, an outdoor rock concert could be scented. So depending on the scale, there are devices there now. And I think the marketers are going to meet up with the technology people, and there's going to be some interesting stuff happening.
Yeah, I believe you. And I was really intrigued by the research that you talk about relating to a store that sold both men's and women's clothing.
Yeah, this fellow Eric Spangenberg, who's a business professor at the University of Washington, went to an off-campus store that sells men's and women's clothes, about equal parts of the store. One week they put a feminine kind of scent in the air, and the next week a masculine scent. And when the feminine scent was up, women's sales almost doubled, number of items and dollars, and men's dropped. And then when the men's scent was in the air, women's sales dropped, but men's sales doubled. So very interesting. There's kind of there's certain expectations and among consumers, and they're very cognitive. People are trying to think through the smells that they see, that they encounter, and act accordingly.
But there are some tricks to it, I think, as you point out, of if the smell, or someone points out that you write about, if the smells are too intense, the smells have to be sort of in the background. If they're too intense, then people spend more time thinking about the smell or identifying the smell than the products in the store.
That's right. If it's too pronounced, it draws attention away from the products or from the atmosphere. So I think the best thing is when you have designers for your establishment who are, you know, people already in hotel lobbies or restaurants, they're very aware of the lighting, the style of it, the colors, the textures that are used in the surfaces, carpets, walls, and so forth. So why not make scent part of that? But it has to be part of the message, and it has to send the same message about the brand or the establishment that the other elements do.
Yeah.
Then it's very successful.
Steve in Madison, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Steve.
Hi. I have never had a sense of smell. I have an older brother who's got a very keen nose, and my mother also. But her mother had no sense of smell, and another older brother of mine also has no sense of smell, and one of his daughters has no sense of smell.
So it sounds like a genetic component to some of this, Avery.
Wow. Steve. I got to get your family into my lab. That's very interesting. Complete loss in a family history like that. That's unusual. Very unusual. I mean, it pops up now and then that a person's born without a sense of smell, and
maybe complete loss is incorrect. I mean, but it has to be something really strong for myself or my brother. And my brother had problems with fainting when he'd have blood taken with rubbing alcohol. Now has amusiodine instead, and he has no problem with fainting.
Aha. Well, you know, the things that you probably can smell are those that are affecting the trigeminal nerve. There's another set of nerves that runs in the eyes, mouth, and inside of the nose. It's the way we sense, say, the burn of chili pepper. And that's kind of, it's an irritation sense. And so when you're getting alcohol or paint fumes or gasoline, things like that, you're sensing it through a different system than the olfactory system.
Interesting. Thank you, Steve, for calling. Boy, an unusual situation. Vicki in Bayfield County, hello to you.
Hi there. I'm like Steve. I was born without a sense of smell, as my aunt also has no sense of smell. And let me tell you, that makes life interesting sometimes. You can go and pet the dog that everybody else can smell has been skunked, and you got no idea until somebody yells at you.
So somebody yells at you. Well, you talk a little about that in your book, too, Avery.
Yeah, I quote this young English girl who was talking about what life was like without a sense of smell, and she said she had a boyfriend that thought she was the best possible girlfriend because he could go down to the pub and bring home takeout curry and stinky food all as much as he liked. He could fart up the apartment as much as he wanted, and she wouldn't complain ever.
Oh, my goodness. Well, and there's some there are obvious downsides, but not being able to smell at all, for example, gas.
Yeah, you know, people, especially those that lose their sense of smell having had one, become very anxious about these issues. Personal hygiene, you know, is my shirt stinky? Do I need to take a shower? Is the gas going on the range? Is the food burning, or is this a bad piece of bologna? And yet, I've looked and looked, and it's very tough to find hard data that people without smell are actually more at risk. I mean, they're not burning themselves up or exploding themselves at the stove in huge enough numbers. So whether that, you know, there's definitely, the anxiety is real, and it's, you know, it's a real possibility, but hard data on the injuries and so forth, hard to find.
No. Thanks for calling, Vicki. Bob in Washington Island, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Larry, and your guest, whose name I forgot already. I experienced a traumatic brain injury maybe 3 or 4 years ago, and did I or did I not experiencing smell loss since then? I'm not sure. But in recent months, I have been looking at the topic of neuroplasticity. And in this area, there is strong evidence that many sense organs can, for one reason or other, be deprived of the connection between the organ and the brain. And what emerges is that some ways you can actually change your brain. And indeed, the book that I'm reading right now is by Sharon Begley, who talks about training your mind, changing your brain. And while I'm only about halfway through, the other interesting thing is that there's a connection, actually, to the University of Wisconsin Neuroscience Department, where there is a prominent gentleman, I believe, Lawson, who actually works in this topical area. But this comment by Carl, where he, you know, sense of smoke, I mean, smoking sensitivity declined, but something else came up. That is just, I think, a classic example of the process of neuroplasticity and rewiring.
Yeah, I think you're right. The brain definitely adapts. You see larger, for example, motor control areas for the fingers of the left hand in violinists and guitar players than in non-musicians and so forth. And so I think, and the sensory part works as well. It wouldn't surprise me to know that perfumers or fragrance chemists have larger areas of the cortex, the thinking part of the brain, devoted to smell, you know, because they're working with it all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's possibly how part of how we come to learn and take for granted some smells, is our brains adapting to them.
Yeah. Thank you, Bob. Appreciate it very much. Kay in Madison, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Kay.
Hi. I remember many years ago when one of the perfume stores in Madison was located in the downtown area, and I would enjoy walking past and getting a whiff of a particular scent that was put out into the air. But nowadays, it seems like there are so many people who are extra sensitive in a negative way, allergic to scent. And that plays a role in marketing, I think, in terms of putting a scent out for people in a magazine or out into the air, whether they would have a lot of complaints from people on smell pollution.
Yeah, this is a common concern. Oddly enough, in the magazine business, say the women's books like Cosmo and Glamour and so forth, the editors there say that their readers love the samples, and it's one of the first things they turn to in the book. But I agree that if it's too loud, so to speak, it could be off-putting. And I think in the same way, you know, if I go into a clothing store with my kids and there's metal music just pounding, I get a headache and I'm out of there, and yeah, my money's not going to be spent there. So, you know, any kind of aesthetic element in marketing that overdoes it, I think, threatens to, at some point, start pushing customers away.
Yeah.
Too bad.
Yeah. Thank you, Kay. Joe in Racine, your turn. Hi, Joe.
Hi. Now, you covered some of the ground that I just wanted to talk about, and that is, what is the difference between natural smells and an ester that are created smells?
Okay.
The natural and synthetic thing is a interesting topic. You've got the perfume and fragrance industry is now able to analyze the components of, say, a natural rose. And there's, you know, dozens of different molecules in there. And they can, having found those molecules, they can then synthetically make them. So I'm not sure, or I'm not sure if anybody's sure, is that recreated smell molecule from a real rose now synthetic or natural? These are some of the kind of, you know, philosophical questions you get into. There's a whole movement afoot for natural perfumery. These are folks who insist on using, you know, as a matter of preference, the essential oils, you know, gums, barks, the original botanical materials that perfumery started with back in the Renaissance. And they come up with some interesting stuff, which tends to be quieter and much more subtle than things that are made with some of the synthetic materials available. It's also more expensive, but it's probably worth it.
Yeah. And you mentioned rose, which clicked a memory for me. In your book, you talk about flowers in general and how flowers have gotten maybe more colorful and brighter and vivid, but have lost their smell. And now researchers are, this is toward the end of your book, I believe, in the sort of biotech area, are looking at reinserting those smells into those flowers, like the rose.
Yeah, I think this is one of the coolest possibilities out there, and it's not so far away. The commercial flower breeders have, as you say, they've concentrated on lovely blossoms and color and vase life, apparently. This is the big thing, make sure they last a long time. But if you go to a typical floral section in your supermarket, a lot of those blossoms don't have much scent because that just got left out of the breeder's concerns. So some researchers, especially at the University of Michigan, are looking at is taking the original variety of, say, that rose that had a great scent. They've isolated the genes that create that scent, and you can take those genes and put them into today's commercial varieties that are scentless and then restore the scent. So that would be a very kind of cool and attractive use of biotechnology and gene transfer.
Sure would. John in Milwaukee, it's your turn next. Hi, John.
Oh, hi, guys. You know, I just saw a movie where this gentleman presented some flowers to his date, and he apologized because they didn't have a scent to them. And he said, I bought them in a deli. I guess if you want the scent, you have to go to a florist shop. But the reason I'm calling is I saw a TV show, like a Ripley sort of thing once years ago, where this man, they gave him 5 glasses of water. Each glass contained water from one of the Great Lakes. and he could identify which lake it came from by, you know, like a wine tasting sort of routine, you know. He had a super sense of taste, and I don't know how much smell incorporated in that, too. But maybe smell and taste, they must go hand in hand somewhat.
They do, and the idea that he could discriminate the five great lakes by water aroma alone is a cool one. I think I have an example in the book. You know, people, the human nose gets a bad rap. It gets short shrift. Everybody says, oh, dogs are much better, or rabbits are much better. And in fact, when you look at, you know, in the laboratory, molecule for molecule, what levels they can pick up and what levels we can pick up, we do pretty well. And we can even pick out the, in melted ice cream, we can tell the ice creams apart based on where the maple stick for the ice, for the popsicle came from, whether it was from China, Canada, Wisconsin. So, you know, and if you present it that way, it's like, whoa, those amazing humans.
And taste, as you, I think you said earlier, taste is really the tongue can only identify what, five is it?
Yeah, we're up to five.
Yeah, we're up to five. Whereas the nose has a lot more. Well, can identify many, many more things.
Right. There's a lot more channels there, and I think in some ways we might even have an edge over animals in the evolution of these receptors, because so much of what we smell, you know, I think people get a bad rap because we're not very good at smelling, say, a deer or a gazelle on the savanna from, you know, 2 miles upwind. On the other hand, when it comes to spicing and seasoning cooked gazelle over the campfire,
yeah,
and then savoring the taste in the mouth and that way up through the back of the throat, we're picking up a lot of components that probably don't even hit a dog or a lion that just rips and gulps its food. I think we've probably been selected for receptors that are food-related due to our history as a cooking and spicing species.
Dale in Johnson Creek, it's your turn. Hi, Dale.
Hi. This afternoon, I am going to a nose and throat specialist just because I can't smell anything or taste anything since about March or April when I had a sinus infection. And I was wondering what I should be asking him or looking for.
Well, that's after head injury, sinus infection is the other way that people commonly lose smell. Especially with folks who are like in their 40s or up, that kind of the risk goes up statistically. The good news for you is if that, in fact, is the cause, and there are other causes that are remediable, like nasal polyps, that's something your doctor will look for. But the good news is that often smell returns. It might take a couple of months, and it might not come back 100%, but the odds are better for you than for somebody with a head injury or trauma.
Hmm.
The only good effect of it, I'm losing weight out of it because nothing tastes good.
Well, there's an upside.
Thanks, Dale. Oh, boy. Paul in Ozaukee County. Hi, Paul.
Hi, guys. I'm very interested in this program. And earlier, you were just talking about channels. And I always had an excellent sense of smell to the point where my brother referred to me as the family beagle. But about 7 years ago, I lost it completely. And now as it's gradually coming back, it's as if I'm partially colorblind. So that, for instance, I can, with my eyes closed, open the Sunday New York Times and the Sunday Milwaukee Journal and know which is which from the smell of the ink. But I cannot detect, for instance, the smell of sour milk, which, of course, drives my wife crazy.
Yeah.
But I'm just wondering if this is a common thing where some channels recover and others don't?
That's an excellent question. In fact, my bias is to agree with you in that the loss is selective. Years ago, I did a study with the National Geographic. We sent out a smell survey, a scratch and sniff test, to 14 million people. We got a million answers back with a range of ages. We had a dozen people over 100 years old. And as you look with aging, in this case, you know, smell can smell acuity falls off, but it doesn't fall off at random. Certain kinds of smells fell out first, like light floral, the rose odor. Mm-hmm. Changed first, and it changed its qualities, the way people described it. So I think that in all of these either injuries or gradual losses, it's probably certain types of smell that are blinking out and not right across the board. So that, your case would agree, it would make sense with that.
Yeah, I had read some research indicating that in terms of primary colors, some researchers thought there were about 1,000. And so right now I'm feeling like, I've got maybe 600 of them back. And so the acuity is high, but to be just nose deaf to something like, I'll say, a dead mouse.
Right. Well, have your wife taste your milk first. That's probably the best.
Thanks, Paul. Bob in Darlington. Hi, Bob.
Well, thanks for taking my call, Larry.
Sure.
Good morning. I was just wondering where the sense of smell ranks in comparison to our other major senses.
Sense of smell has historically always ranked near the bottom. I mean, the ancient philosophers put it near the bottom. They thought it was kind of primitive. We're probably, I don't know how you'd quite quantify this, but we're mainly a visual species. And, of course, we have color vision, which other animals don't. We have very precise vision that allows us to read and use symbols. But I think smell, if you heard from all these folks this morning, we tend to take it for granted until we lose it. And I think it's often at the kind of edge of awareness, but lends a real color and vividness to life that we're sorry to lose when we do.
Yeah. Yep, absolutely. Thank you for calling. Carol in Kenosha. Hold on a second. We'll give you a chance. Hi, Carol.
Okay. I just tuned in about 15 minutes ago, so you may have addressed this. But I have an extreme sensitivity to odors, and something that your guest just said about the trigeminal nerve really, really hit a nerve with me, because I have now been told that I have trigeminal neuralgia. It has involved the nerves in my eye radiating into pain in the whole side of my face, and I had no idea that that was involved with the sense of smell.
Yeah, I think I don't mean to sound insensitive, but it's scientifically, it's a very interesting condition, because the trigeminal nerves are in the eyes, the nose, the face, and mouth, and it can be a nuisance when you have that pain. Also, it can kind of switch over in ways. So an olfactory stimulus, something that's purely a smell, it shouldn't really be triggering that trigeminal nerve, can nonetheless do it sort of by association. So, but at least you've got a doctor who's onto it, and hope that works out for you.
Yeah, and thank you very much for calling, Carol. Appreciate your call. And Avery, thank you so much. I have to tell you that as a professor here on campus, I teach and my colleagues teach classes in science writing and how to communicate science to the public. And I certainly want to use your book as an example of how to communicate science to the public, because you've done a wonderful job with it. It's entertaining and very enlightening. Thank you so much.
Quite welcome. You're very kind.
Avery Gilbert is author of the book What the Nose Knows, and I tell you, there are some hilarious parts in this book as well. We didn't get into the Tudor trappers for good reason, as a matter of fact. But you can find out about those if you read the book. What the Nose Knows, The Science of Scent in Everyday Life. Avery Gilbert, the author. And the book is published by Crown Publishers. Really really an entertaining book. You'll like it. Coming up next, we'll take a look at getting ourselves physically fit with Dustin Maher. Next here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.